You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. Hello and welcome back. We are your hosts, Pat from Lifelong Shuffle and Dave from Strong Money Australia. So guys, we love getting feedback from you. We appreciate all the questions you send. So we have got a few piling up this time for another listener questions episode. We do enjoy doing these Q&A episodes. They do help us cover a few topics that might not need their own episodes and also discuss things that you might be wondering about.
I think these are pretty good episodes. It just gives you and me, Pat, a chance to elaborate on a few topics and ramble on a few things that we might not cover in the other episodes. So it's really enjoyable for us and we think you guys enjoy them too. But just before we start, if you do have a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, we can cover that in a future listener questions episode. You can send those through to fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And just a side note, I don't know if you noticed with these questions, Pat, but they all seem to be investing related.
Yeah, I have.
So should we take that to mean that everyone has completely mastered their personal finances and they don't need any sort of extra information in that area? Or is it just because investing is a little bit more exciting for people?
I think it is because investing is a bit more exciting, a bit sexier. Maybe people perceive it as a bit more complicated. There are thousands of options which you can choose from out there. Thousands of spruikers trying to sell you their latest products. There's always this sexy new thing. There's always... There's no shortage at any point in time of the new thing to get into. And this is going to be even better than what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. So part of our job is probably just to wade through the rubbish and simplify things for people a little bit.
Which is, to be fair, it's like one of my favorite things. Like just being a cynic, just scrutinizing. It's like, oh, how about this? I'm like, no, just why? Why? No, stop it. Stop it. No.
Especially when it's something that's maybe assumed to be much better than what's already being done or what's already on offer, like you said before.
Yeah, it's all flashy. It's all, oh, this is it, guys. Like, it's going to be good. I swear this time.
The new way. It's the new way.
It's the new way. Yeah. That's part of becoming an old grumpy lady or man. But in Dave and our case, grumpy old men of the investing world. You just look at crap, like flow in through the front door to the front door. And you're like, no, go away. You just learn.
And it's all trying to attract our investment dollars, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. And you just learn that 99.99% of the crap that comes to your front door is just that. It's crap.
What's that line? Most investments are sold, not bought.
Ah, yeah, that's right.
Meaning that they're for selling, not really for investing in.
Yeah, for good reason. Makes people money, just not you.
Yeah. All right, let's get started. Let's bring in our first question for this week. All right, so you guys spoke a bit about REITs before, which if you're listening and you're not sure what REITs are, they are real estate investment trusts. So the question continues, but what are your thoughts on unlisted commercial property funds? Mm-hmm. And so if you're not aware of what that might be, that is essentially commercial property funds that are unlisted. They operate basically like managed funds do with shares. And you'll deal directly with a manager of those assets. You're not buying it through your brokerage platform or anything like that. You'll be dealing direct with the manager and they'll collect a bunch of money for different investment projects or whatever they might be doing. And so these commercial property funds, what tends to happen is there's a couple of different types. There's like development funds where you can tip in a bunch of cash depending on what the requirements are or what the rules are, and it might be like a 2 or 3 year project where they'll do the they'll raise the money, do the development, and then hopefully return the profits to investors later on, and that project will be finished at that point because it was just for development only. But then there are some other options where it's like more of a long-term portfolio where the manager will go out and buy, say, 5 different commercial properties, or maybe more, it depends on, they're all different. Those assets will be managed and held for 7 to 10 years or whatever, and then they might be sold at the end and the cash will be returned to investors and they would have received their rental income along the way. So there is a couple of different types, and what are our thoughts on it? It's an option, but it really depends whether you want to have like extra commercial property in your portfolio or not. You are getting some inside, say, like a typical index fund. I think the Australian index fund is around about 6 or 7% real estate trusts, and the global index fund is maybe 2 or 3%. So it's not a lot, but you do have some exposure in there. I don't really like the development funds because I don't want to just put cash in and then a development occurs and now I'm hoping that I get a profit in 3 years and then I've got that lump of money again. I've got to reinvest that somewhere else and then I'll have to pay tax on that short-term profit. It just doesn't really, it just seems risky to me, that short-term strategy and project to make some quick money, essentially, you hope, and then you've still got to reinvest that money elsewhere. So I don't really like those options. The longer-term ones are more interesting, but then I still don't like that a lot of the time the assets are sold after 10 years or whatever it might be. That's not always the case, but
yeah,
it is for a few of them. So yeah, I'm not really keen on those. If personally, I do have some other real estate investment trusts other than what's inside index funds, for example. So I own 2 real estate trusts, but they're actually listed ones. So they're just listed on the share market and you can buy those like you would any other company.
Mm.
And I like those because I wanted a bit of extra commercial property than what is inside the index fund, and I like the assets that they own, and that's like a buy and hold strategy where they hold the portfolio and maybe acquire other assets and just pay a healthy income stream each year. And so that kind of fits in with my strategy and that's what I like. But the unlisted, I don't really like that idea because you can't really get your money out, or it's very restricted and when you can get your money out and how much, the manager kind of controls that, so you have a lot less flexibility over what's happening with an access if it is unlisted.
Yeah, right.
So that's my thoughts. What do you think about this idea, Pat? Unlisted commercial property.
Well, firstly, it sounds like you've looked into this pretty closely, so you sounds like you actually know a lot about this. So did you
I wouldn't say a
seriously
lot
seriously consider it? But you know enough that it sounds like you, not that you seriously considered it, but you researched it to see if it would be something you'd be interested in.
Yeah, I've looked at some different options. I wouldn't say I've done a crap load of research or anything like that. But yeah, I've looked at the different options and seen what there is available. And I didn't really like most of the options. I don't mind the idea of owning a bit of commercial real estate. And commercial real estate in Australia tends to pay pretty high level of income, which suits me because I'm essentially not really paying tax at the moment, being an early retiree. So that kind of fits with how I like to invest also. That does fit in with my style, but yeah, I'm not sure about you, Pat.
No, fair enough. So the first sort of things that come to mind, and you can pull me up here, Dave, if I'm going down the wrong path. This is basically like private equity funds that invest in maybe infrastructure as well, or commercial property or anything like that.
They're private funds that may or may not have a big manager that's running those funds.
Yeah.
But private equity tends to mean like private business. Private businesses that you're buying into.
Right.
This is more like a managed fund that's not listed on the share market.
Yeah, okay. And so if they're buying... Yeah, okay.
So they might...
First things...
So they might be buying like your local Bunnings or an office building in the city or something like that, and holding that property and passing the income on to investors.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So I suppose this is pretty similar to... I wrote a post a while ago about superannuation and about private equity and superannuation. And this is... I feel like it has all the same problems, all the same issues as that. The first being... problems with private valuation, which after they've bought the property, say in the first couple of years, they essentially have to get the properties privately valued every so often. And that drives the unit price that they sell the the managed trust units. And I understand that this is literally the only way they can do this is get private valuations. But I just have a problem with that. I don't like private valuations because they're open to corruption or to tinkering to support the private manager's goal or outcome to show that they're driving a profit. And those of you that don't know, private valuation just means that instead of the market pricing the cost, it's literally someone coming along and pricing up the value of all the assets within the unit, within the investment. That doesn't sit well with me because I don't trust private valuation. You can, if you trust it, then sure. Second thing is, sounds like same as private equity, there's typically a whole bunch of leverage involved or high amounts of leverage involved. That could be different from
there is leverage manager involved to manager. In a lot of cases, but it's not really high leverage. It's usually like maybe 30% or something like that. It's not like your...
So I consider 30 to 50% high amount of leverage.
It's not like your average property investor.
No, it's 80, not a retail property. Okay, so there's some amount of leverage involved.
But that's the case for listed businesses as well, though.
Fair enough.
So you're not really avoiding that by investing in listed shares.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
And a lot of listed... You can argue that a lot of listed shares also have the same problem with valuations because we see a lot of either markups or write-downs in listed companies, the assets that they own. And often it's the managers themselves or the company themselves that's allowed to write up and write down the value of whatever assets it's owned. But these assets that might be like a commercial property is usually valued by a third party. And obviously that's not bulletproof, but you're not really avoiding that particular scenario of the opinion of the value of something by investing only in listed shares.
Yeah, but does a company have a reason or a motivation to unrealistically price their assets? Because the company itself doesn't care about the share price.
You could argue everyone does.
Really?
The company doesn't care about the share price. Why not? What about when it issues options for executives and compensation like that tied to share price? We've talked about this a little bit before. So every company has a vested interest in seeing its share price higher. So
Yeah. Raising capital, it does make raising capital. But just on one more tangent, and we can see if we can talk about this. Whenever you're investing in something that is unlisted, I feel like you need to be much more careful with where you invest and how you get exposure to that asset, just because it is so easy to be conned there in the world outside of listed investments. Like, it's super easy to make a slick looking investment website. It's super Dave and I could put together a slick looking investment website in less than an afternoon and then just advertise it in places and see what hits we get from, unfortunately, people.
I was just going to say, that's a really good point because when something is listed, it's being scrutinized on a regular basis by thousands of analysts.
Yes.
So they're digging into the financials, they're digging into the operations and trying to suss what that company or what that fund is really doing and whether it's legit or not. But when something is private, you're not getting that same level of... The funds or the companies aren't being held to the same level of scrutiny. I'd say you move into a not less regulated environment, but you know where I'm going with that.
Yes.
Less scrutinized environment where you can maybe get away with things a little bit more.
Definitely. And it's not even that it's just less scrutinized. Even if unlisted investments are being applied the same scrutiny, making sure that this is a legitimate unlisted fund. So I'm sure unlisted funds fall under the scrutiny of some of the regulations. I read about it all the time because it's something that interests me. It's so easy to get conned into things that look like legitimate unlisted funds, who look like legitimate investments. But it's just, once you're looking at in the listed environment, you can be relatively certain that this is at the very least a legitimate investment and a con, say. It might not be a good investment, but it's a legitimate business or a legitimate investment fund.
Yeah, fair enough. On this particular topic of commercial property funds, to try and avoid that, you would just go to a manager who has run commercial property funds for 30 or 40 years, for example, rather than one that started 2 years ago and you've never really heard of it before.
So who would a manager like that?
So that would, there's a big one called Charter Hall. I think they might be the biggest in Australia and they own a lot of like shopping centers and things like that. And I think they've been managing real estate for 40 years or something like that. So you could be And they operate listed and unlisted funds.
Yeah, okay.
So you could be a little bit more, there's a couple of other ones as well. You could be a bit more comforted in the fact that they've been around for a long time and you can check their funds out and be sure that it's not something that's been started last year by Bob in his backyard who's trying to make a few bucks.
But how do I know that? So you know that, right? Because you've been in like that space for a while. But how do I know that Charter Hall sounds exactly the same as Burton's Investments?
Well, there's this awesome thing called Google.
Yeah.
And when you have a query, type it in there and you can look up the history of something so you can see how long a company's been operating for. And
yeah. So the key, you know what I mean? The key of what I'm getting at here.
Do your research.
Well, the key, yeah, exactly. The key of what I'm getting at here is try and find information about the investment manager in places other than the investment managers. Look it up on Google, see if they're like from some of the more popular investment articles or websites or news places, and don't just rely on a website that looks like it can look very, very professional and very legitimate and say things such as, oh, we've been operating for 40 years and we have all these investments. You need to find that information from a third party source.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
this isn't necessarily a knock on unlisted investment property or unlisted investment trust. It's just to be careful when you're investing in those and apply more due diligence when you want to.
Yeah. I think for me, the part that puts me off is really the access of not being able to. If you want to get your money back for whatever reason, you need it for something else, or you just want to invest elsewhere, you change your mind or whatever, you can't just sell those shares or sell those units and get your money back in most cases in a few days like you can with listed shares or listed real estate trusts. So that's the part that really puts me off.
Yeah, so there's huge liquidity issues, is there? Like you just via rules or just via having to find other buyers. It's not that easy.
I think in a few cases, if the manager is a large manager and they're dealing with a lot of inflows and outflows, you can get your money back a bit sooner and there's a little bit more flexibility there. But for some that may, they may really just have a lockup where you can't get your money for a certain number of years or much more restrictions on when and how much you can get back. But I haven't done that much research into it, into all the different options. But yeah, it's definitely trickier and that's off-putting for me.
That sounds shit, honestly. It does. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Why wouldn't you just go for a listed real estate investment trust? What is the appeal of an unlisted when compared to a listed?
That's a good question. I think for a lot of people, it's the, for one thing, unlisted tend to pay like a monthly distribution. They'll get the rent and they'll pay like the monthly income to people. Whereas with listed, it tends to be like a quarterly distribution. I think people like that. But then, no, I'm serious. I think that's one of the reasons.
I know you're serious, but it's such a...
It's pretty trivial, I think.
It's so trivial. Like, yeah. It's a trivial reason to take on that, all those negatives we just talked about.
Yeah. And the other reason is I think people like to be sheltered from the volatility of the price moving. So they want to buy commercial real estate, but when they buy through like a listed real estate trust, that price moves every day and it can move substantially like in any other share. And so people don't like that. And by investing in an unlisted commercial property fund, they are sheltered.
This just goes back to the private valuation thing I was saying.
Oh, yes and no, because you would find that something's listed, the price moves a lot more than the underlying value of the assets that it owns.
Yeah, yeah.
A big real estate trust might move in price by 30% up or down. But the unit price, even if those properties are continually valued, it won't move by 30% in a couple of months. Commercial real estate just doesn't really do that. People are sheltered from that. And I think that's one of the big reasons that they go for the unlisted option.
Yeah. Again, that's a pretty...
It's
not a great reason.
It is kind of funny because at the end of the day, you're still tied to the success of those assets.
Yeah.
If those assets do well, you'll do well. If they don't, you won't.
So, like you said, it's just a shield. Like you just don't see it.
Yeah.
It's still there in the background, but you're shielded from it. I also have issues with perhaps less diversification than you could probably get elsewhere in some of these property trusts.
Depends what you're comparing it to though, because... If someone's going to put in, I don't know, a couple of hundred grand into a unlisted property fund, that's probably better than trying to buy a little commercial shop for 200 grand. But
you're
if you're
right.
comparing it to an index fund, then there's no comparison. You wouldn't compare them anyway. So it depends what you're comparing it against.
I'm comparing it to index funds because they're my...
Well, why would you compare them?
Well, why would you compare it to anything else? Like they're so easy to get into. They're like the gold standard. They're like, you can just invest in this. And
well, because someone's obviously looking at this in particular because they're interested in adding some commercial, some extra like commercial real estate to their portfolio.
So and that person has asked for my opinion. And my opinion is, why bother? Just invest in an index fund. Why do you want that concentration?
It depends how much of it they're going to put in their portfolio.
Yeah, yeah.
So it really depends. They might be putting maybe 5% of their portfolio into a commercial fund, and that 5% might 50 buildings.
Mm.
So they're really putting a tiny, tiny portion into each commercial property asset in their portfolio.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's diversification gets a bit extreme and gets a bit slippery to try and tie down what's concentrated and what's not, but.
Yeah, 50 properties is definitely better than one. I agree.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Way better.
All right, we done enough on that one?
Yeah, probably.
All right, let's go to question two.
Have you guys thought of discussing actual assets you foresee doing well over the next 10, 20, or 30 years? Lots of newbies would be really interested in where they could be funneling their investment money to set them up for the future.
Mm.
Oh, here we go.
This is pretty interesting, hey, because it's something that, imagine if we did a podcast just about this. It would be probably the most popular episode. Maybe not, depending on our audience. But in general, this kind of topic is what podcasts are entirely devoted to. This topic of finding the best investments for the next 10, 20, 30 years. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, sometimes you see titles of these podcasts and, the four sectors you should be looking at for the massive growth in the next 3 years or something. And like, gosh, this is going to be crap. Here we go.
It's so seductive though that it really sucks most people in.
Yeah. Sometimes I forget that we've been so like well-tuned to see the bullshit. And every time I see crap like that, I'm just like, oh, this is going to be crap. Here we go.
Yeah.
But most people, you're right. They might look at that and think, oh yeah, let's look at this.
Yeah. It takes a while to develop a filter like you and I have, Pat.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, like this idea sounds awesome. Mm. And I'd love to know what's going to do the best over the next 30 years. Who wouldn't? But the problem is everybody is just completely guessing. Nobody actually has any clue what is going to do the best over the next few decades. And if something is super obvious, if it can be at all obvious what's going to be the best investment, then it's probably already been bid up today because it's so obvious. So the price of, you're going to be paying probably a premium for that asset because it is so clear that's what's going to be doing well in the future.
Correct, yes.
So it's very tricky to navigate this scenario without thinking a few layers into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you can't just think this is good, it's going to do well. It's not as simple as that.
No, yeah. So something that really catches a lot of people out is just because a certain sector is going to do well doesn't mean if you invest in that sector, your investments will do. So a great example of this may be electric vehicles. I won't name the specific electric vehicle manufacturer, but if you really, really believe that electric vehicles are going to be the future and you want to invest in that area because you think your investments will henceforth do really well, it's not that simple because a lot of other people have already had that idea and they've already invested in, let's say, Tesla and bid its price right up. So the expectation of doing really well in the future has already been taken into account and the price has already gone up to reflect that. So the return on the investment at that new bid up price isn't going to be any better than the return on your investments where you can get anywhere else.
Mm. And I suppose one way of figuring out whether this is the case is thinking this idea that I have of company X or thematic X that's supposed to do well over the next few decades, how many people are talking about that? If a lot of people are talking about that, forget about it because the prices have already been bid up. But if it's something that you genuinely believe in that very, very few people or almost nobody is talking about, then maybe you are right. But then because that's the case, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty around that. So it's definitely not a slam dunk either. You just might have a little bit more chance because nobody's talking about it yet. But it's still far from certain it's going to play out the way you hope it will.
Yeah, precisely. I don't know about you, Dave, but I try not to think what asset class is going to do well over the next decades. Instead, if I'm ever like tempted to think in that way in terms of thematics or countries, I just try and picture like scenarios in which I'm wrong and then what that's going to do to my portfolio return. And it's always, oh, if I'm wrong about this, then I've reduced my risk. Why do I want to take that risk compared to just global cap-weighted index funds. And then on the flip side, I try to think of scenarios in which I'm actually correct. It's, oh, over the next 10 years, I guessed correct, and this industry has done well, and it's made me a lot of money. But at what point do I then decide, okay, when do I decide to get out of this industry? When has it done well enough that its prospects are no longer good in the future? Or, and then where am I going to go after that? Am I going to try and pick the next big winner? Am I going to go back to index funds? Am I going to suffer capital gains tax to sell out of that huge position along the way? And then after all of that nonsense of complication, capital gains tax, etc., has it really been worth it versus just investing in global cap-weighted index funds?
Yeah, it starts getting pretty tricky, doesn't it?
It does. And then in 10 years or 20 years, what if I'm no longer around and my partner has all the money? Is she going to be able to sell it all and then get into a more diversified balanced portfolio? You really consider 10, 20, 30 years is a long time. And for me personally, it's just not worth the hassle compared to a basic global cap weighted index fund portfolio, which will always be a good portfolio to invest in.
Yes, it's tricky. People want to know what the best investments are, but the thing is, they don't really need to know what the best investments are. They only need to know what some good investments are. They don't have to be the best. They just have to be like good, long-term good choices.
Yeah. And the key is, like, when you're trying to pick the best investments, what the best investment is will change from year to year, decade to decade. But picking, like you said, a good investment will always be a good investment. It's like something you don't have to tinker with. It's something that you can just leave in the background for the next 40, 50, 60 years and just let it do its thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because you're keeping it simpler at that by doing it that way. The more you try and pick and choose what's going to be the best, the more complicated your investing tends to get.
Yeah.
And the more decisions there is to make. So I like to keep things big and broad and like pretty simple. So when we're investing, we're all just making like bets, right? By investing in Australian shares, I'm betting that the long-term future of Australia is going to be pretty good. By investing in international shares, I'm betting that the global economy is going to do just fine over the next 30 years. So I like to keep it pretty big and pretty simple. If those things turn out to be true, I'll do just fine. And I don't see any reason to think that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. So in short, Dave and I don't know what's going to be good over the next 10, 20, 30 years. Even if we did think we knew, I would probably still just invest the way I'm investing now anyway. Not that I could ever know.
That's the way I think of it. Like, I can't know, so why should I bother trying so hard to figure it out when in all likelihood that's not going to be the case, or I'm going to be half right and it's not, all the effort and stress and complications is not going to be worth it.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, that's the most disappointing answer someone's ever received, or what, Pat? What do you reckon?
I almost feel like we have failed in this podcast because we're getting that question. Like, I thought we've been pretty clear. Don't try and bet on any individual thing or any individual thematic or country or stock. I try and profusely say, oh, just keep it basic. Put your money into a giant basket of everything, because it's proven to be the most successful way to invest. Taking these active bets not only tend to be less successful over the long term, but they just add so much complication and anxiety to your investments that I don't feel are worth it.
Speaking of active bets, ready for question 3?
Oh, okay. All right. Yes, let's go.
I understand the choice to invest in index funds to grow your wealth, but would you deviate to invest in a single stock if someone you trusted showed you a well-researched and considered opinion on the prospects and the value of an individual stock? Or would you just stay focused on the main goal? And if you would invest in a single stock, where do you draw the line? Would you do it once, twice, 10 times? Ooh, interesting, Pat.
Right in the question, they have drawn our attention to at least one of the issues with trying to invest in individual stocks.
Right at the end there?
Yeah, right at the end. So it's good. They're already thinking about it. Yeah.
What's your thoughts, mate?
When I was younger and less grumpy old man-wise, I would have. But now I hate looking at those individual stocks in my portfolio and their volatility. I'm not so sure of them as I am with the global cap-weighted index funds and the Australian index funds. And they annoy me. I really like the simplicity. They do. Just having them there, like having a stock sitting next to my index funds, I'm like, oh, I could just be looking at my 4 index funds instead of this stupid stock sitting here, adding additional volatility. And I don't like that the outcome of my entire portfolio Neo is now being driven in part by this additional holding. And I dislike it so much that I'll even go to the effort and pay some CGT to get my portfolio back to just index fund. So the answer is a slam dunk no.
You can't be tempted.
No, I really can't be tempted. I don't see the point. And if we just war game this a bit, how much of your portfolio are we talking about here to take individual stock bet? 5%, 10%, 20%? Is 20% getting too much? Do you really want 20% of your money being driven by the outcome of a few stocks? If it's less than 20, let's say it's 10%, is the outcome of those few stocks going to have a material difference to your net worth, even if they go to the moon?
Like, if it is 10%, it would.
Would?
Yeah, of course. Of course it would.
Yeah, okay. It could also just disappear.
Yeah, of course. And I suppose that's the trade-off, and that's what you were getting at with what you were saying, that you much prefer the certainty of return over the long term from the holdings that you have rather than the hope or expectation of a fantastic return, even if that was to come about. You much prefer the certainty of what you've got because you can be much more confident in those holdings over your lifetime than you can over something else.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about at the end of the day. You have to have be comfortable and have confidence in what you're holding and why. And I agree with you. I almost completely agree with you in terms of I love the certainty of owning things that I know I can own for a long time and be very confident that they'll do well. So I love that aspect of big, simple investments like index funds. But I would listen to whoever this was that had this idea. I would consider it. If it's like a hot tip from your mate at the pub, probably not. But it's been framed as this is someone you trust and it's a well-researched opinion on a certain company. Yeah, I'd consider it. How many times? Probably only once or twice. And if you start getting too wrapped up in this, then it starts to consume all your mental energy and all your time and all the kind of issues that Pat was bringing up. And I think it makes your investing less enjoyable when there's more kind of stress involved. So I could only tolerate maybe one or two of these things. And even then, it would only be a small part of the portfolio, like a very small percentage. And it would be partly for enjoyment. And I would make it so that if it didn't work, and I would have expectations that it's probably not going to work. And I would have no kind of hopes that it was going to go to the moon or anything like that. I would just set my expectations very low, and if it worked out, great, and if it didn't, it wouldn't matter, because I would make sure that my main portfolio, which was still focused on those long-term investments that I don't have to do anything with, I don't have to think about, so that even if this one or two picks that I was interested in or whatever, if they didn't work, it would not make a difference at all to my long-term portfolio. So if this is you, if this sounds like something you're interested in, if you keep it small and stay focused on the main portfolio on the side, if you want to do a little bit of this out of interest, or you have a mate who really knows what he's doing, then I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But still focus on your main, like the main objective and the main portfolio. And if this kind of works out, then great. But if it doesn't, just make sure it's not going to hurt you much at all by keeping it really small.
Can I just one more addition? I actually read an article on JL Collins' website very recently that's very pertinent to this sort of discussion. So we should definitely put that in the show notes. And it's basically a story about JL Collins. If you don't know him, he's like pretty famous in the FIRE community. Right, retire early. He talks about FU money, and he's made an excellent series of blog posts called the Stock Series. But he actually sets out this entire story about getting in with like boutique investment fund, and this investment fund finding like this company that had this great technology, and they like researched them intensely, and they knew everything about this tiny little company to the point where all of the investment managers were putting significant amounts of their personal wealth into this single company. And he basically just really painted this story about how well researched that they were into this company, and basically that no one could ever possibly have done more due diligence, and they all just lost their money.
What happened?
Oh, the technology ended up not being as fruitful as they thought it would be, and yeah, it was rubbish. So I take umbrance with the lies. If someone you trust showed you very well researched and considered opinion on the prospects, my opinion is that no one can ever research enough or know enough about the prospects of a company to make me confident enough to invest in it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. So the research research is better than not doing research, but you still should have basically zero expectations that's going to be a fruitful pick over the long term. You should go into it with very low expectations and a small enough position that it's not going to make any difference at all to your goals, because you don't want that kind of hanging over your head like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You don't want to regret that in the future.
No. And that web page from J.L. Collins called Mariah International, All That Glitters. So we'll link to that and have a read of it definitely. If you're of this disposition, and it might sway you back the other way.
Yeah, good stuff. I'll put that in the show. All right, question four. If you're in a situation where you need to sell some shares, how do you choose which shares to sell? I have invested in ETFs only, 5 different ones. So what are the things that you look at to determine which shares to sell? The ones that have performed the best, the ones that have performed the worst, or something else? This is a good question.
So firstly, if your 5 ETFs are your target portfolio, that's great. But in the first instance, if you have some cats and dogs in your portfolio that you want to get rid of, then they're an obvious first place that you can start to sell shares, like individual stocks from earlier days, or investments that you've kept around because you don't want to take the CGT hit, but now that you need to sell something, that might be worth getting rid of.
Yeah, so if that's the case, then yeah, sell any that you aren't really keen on keeping over the long term. That would be the easiest kind of first choice. And then with the ones that you do keep, I suppose you have a few different options. You could take some money out of each of them, and that would keep your portfolio roughly how it is now, if you are happy with how it is. Or if you have no kind of target portfolio, then you could sell what's had the best recent performance, and that kind of lets you cash out some gains, although you might have to pay some tax on that, and then keep those in your portfolio which have lagged, because as we've said before, the performance does tend to even out if you're in like big broad kind of index funds, investments like that. But the thing is, you can't really know which ETF is going to be the best to sell, because you don't know which is going to have the best performance in the future. So it's almost like another type of regret minimization game, where you're probably going to look at it later and know which one you should have sold, but you can't know that now. So you have to be okay with that. Be okay with that uncertainty of not knowing which one is going to be the best to sell in terms of having the best performance in the future. So it's a little bit tricky. I would probably just get rid of the one or two or whatever maybe that you don't want to keep long term, or cash out a little bit of each or something like that.
I think an important question to ask this person is, how do you choose which ETF to buy? Because that's not clear from the question they asked us. So typically, for what I personally do is like my 4 ETF portfolio, and I have a certain percentage allocation target to each of those 4 ETFs that I'm trying to maintain over time. And the way I maintain them is that whenever I make a new purchase, I choose the one which is furthest from its percentage target to purchase. So if I was going to sell ETFs, I would just do the opposite. The one that's furthest above its target, I would sell that one. And so the question we then have to ask is, how much is this person trying to sell? Is it like 30% of their entire portfolio, or is it like some tiny amount? Is it 1%? If it's like 1%, then just choose like the one that's furthest from the target, sell that one that's furthest above its target, sorry. But if it's something like 30%, then like you said, you could sell a bit of each to try and still maintain what you want your portfolio to look like.
Yeah, it really depends on what you want your portfolio to look like going forward, and make that your framework of how to choose what to trim or what to get rid of maybe.
Yeah. So is that all our questions for today?
That's it, man.
Nice. Hopefully we didn't ramble too much there, but I think we got through most of them all right.
All right. So if you have a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, again, you can send those through to fireandchillpod@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you could leave us a quick little review, podcast app, wherever you listen. It just helps other people know that this is a show worth listening to. And so we appreciate it if you can do that. As always, you can get more from our blogs. You'll find Pat at his blog, lifelongshuffle.com, and you'll find me at my blog, strongmoneyaustralia.com. All right, thanks again, and we'll catch you next time.